Namaste. So today, as we have decided, after every six chapters or six classes, we have question answers. So today is question answers. It could be on the subject, it could be anything related, because Shobhinda and the mother, Sri Krishna, they are as vast as creation itself. So the questions are related to sacrifice. In its most elementary form, just to bring back the perspective, sacrifice means giving. That's the most common thing, I sacrifice. But the sense of sacrifice comes only when we are parting with something which is important to us, which we value. So when we give something, it is sacrifice. And this giving may involve from the most material thing to the most highest. That means by most material means money. The highest is, as the Gita says, the sacrifice of knowledge itself. So how do we give knowledge? It's not just imparting knowledge. No, it's like whatever we may know, we offer it to the divine so that we may have room for receiving more and more. This knowledge itself gets uplifted to higher and higher levels. And in between, there are different types of sacrifice. Emotions are sacrificed, life energies are sacrificed. So this is the first aspect. And someone may sacrifice entirely oneself. So this is one part, what is sacrifice. Then the sacrifice may be to the lower gods. So I may sacrifice myself entirely, but to my family, because of a desire to see my family members do well in life. Or maybe when I am old, when I need them, they will be there around me. So here the sacrifice is there, but it is to lower gods. Why lower gods? Gods who fulfill desires, gods who fulfill our ambitions. So why Sri Krishna is using the language gods? Because as the Vedic knowledge goes, behind all that we receive and all that we give, there is a transaction that takes place. Gods are cosmic managers, and to each god is given his own place and position assigned in this cosmos. And at some point, they sanction. So I may desire something, but it's not sanctioned. Now, how they sanction? They sanction based on their own inner knowledge that, well, here things must go. And this sanctioning of the fruit is not based only on how much I have worked. It's not a mathematical thing. I may have worked a lot, and yet the gods don't sanction it. Because they have the account, they are immortal. So they have the account of all that has gone in the past. They have an account of what is going to come. They have an account of many things which we don't take into consideration. So they sanction based on this knowledge. Whereas I may have given more work, effort, let's say in a competitive exam to clear. Somebody else may have given less effort. And yet the gods who sanction the success may look at it very differently. So it may be to the lower gods to satisfy desires and ambition. And as Sri Krishna reminds us that if we do that, even then, all these gods, the final sanction has to come from the divine. So he says that ultimately the chain goes like this. You hand over your application, it goes all the way to Supreme. And it's a process ongoing in nature each moment. So nature is constantly offering all this, and the gods are carrying it right up to the Supreme. And from there comes the sanction, acceptance, or allowing things to happen in a certain way, or a refusal. And finally, in the last, they hand over to us whatever is due to us. So Sri Krishna says that when you do that, then the problem is that when we sacrifice for the sake of fulfilling desire or ambition, then the supreme goal of yoga is not fulfilled. We get what we desire, we get what we are striving for, ambition, by that I mean external objects, but we don't get freedom from ignorance, which is the object of spiritual life. So many of these places which we see in India, this knowledge is there everywhere, but in India we see people who go for healing sessions, who go for getting certain benefit. So before elections, many of the contestants, they will go to many of these tantric gurus. I don't like to use the word gurus, but they have in their control certain entities. And these entities can actually play a role. You know, there is very strange. There are people who have noted the action of these entities. So they have powers even to suddenly stun your enemy. So he can't, he is paralyzed, he can't do much. Mother uses the word adverse forces and all these things. But in the Indian pantheon, the larger sense, it is all there, Shudra Devta, the lower gods. Shobindu uses the word little, kingdom of the little gods. So they have within their control certain things. And if they were to transmit exactly what the divine will is, life would be wonderful. But that's where the problem lies, as the mother says, that each of them, each of these form makers, they slightly distort it. So they become partial. They are limited entities. So they can be also clouded by ignorance. They become partial. Within limits, they can't be totally partial. But to an extent, they become partial. And they also have their own law that if there is a bhakta, they will give it to that bhakta. They are compelled to give. And they are compelled to give. They can't ultimately change the highest destiny. That's not in their hands. But within means, limits, they can delay it. They can create a problem. So Sri Krishna advises that instead of giving to these gods, if you want to give, you give. It's your freedom. The only sacrifice which has a spiritual meaning is sacrificing to the highest. When we sacrifice to the highest, we get the highest result. Because only the highest can give us liberation or freedom from ignorance. This is the basic logic. But here also, if we may sacrifice to the highest with desire for earthly goods, he will also grant us. That's what Sri Krishna says, that he can. Obviously, he is the highest, he can give. But the difference is when we aspire to the highest and there also we place an earthly demand, say in our connection with the mother, we ask for things which are material things, which may be for ourselves and our very selfish needs. So then when she is granting, there is a natural corrective. Sri Aurobindo says that either she lets you go through that experience that this was not really what I needed, or she gives you just that which you will take care of your actual need and not necessarily of your greed. So there is a difference. When we ask the gods, they don't have this degree of total vision. Whereas when we turn to the highest gives us. But the greatest self-giving is when there is no demand, not even desire for spiritual liberation, but the joy of giving oneself to the divine. That's what we read in the Gita. And Sri Krishna says that where one seeks neither liberation nor anything, because that's the last illusion, but just for the joy of self-giving to the divine, which is the highest form. And then what will happen? One doesn't calculate, one doesn't think. The divine takes care in his own way. Whatever he wants or knows our need is, he takes care. And whatever is really good for us, he does that. And of course, we get the highest good because in any case, he takes care of that. So this is what is meant by sacrifice. There is also this thing very beautiful that whether we like it or not, nature extracts sacrifice. Nobody can do anything in this world only for oneself. Because this is a relational world. Nobody is cut off. So even if you say, no, I don't believe in sacrifice. I live for my selfishness. You can't. You go to buy some food from a place. Food has come from elsewhere. Like we said, the entire thing cycle is involved in it. You can't buy a grain of rice or wheat without, along with that, receiving something of all those who have gone in that produce. And similarly, when we eat, we give, even the very waste that we produce, even that goes into nature and nature uses it in its own way. So this is the cycle. Whether we like it or not, sacrifice is extracted from us. We may do it for this person, that person for family, this, that. So better sacrifice consciously, sacrifice to the highest. And of course, highest good comes to those who sacrifice to the highest. So here again, just to complete the picture, even with the gods, there were two kinds of sacrifice. One was transactional. Transactional means I give this, we'll see in Greek mythology as well as Indian mythology, that we give some money or we give something external to the god, deity, Sometimes we make a temple of the deity. And there is a desire inside for something which is material. And the deity in turn gives it to us. But it need not be transactional, it may be transformational. Transformational means I give something of myself. And I don't desire anything but the deity for the sake of the deity. Then it becomes transformational, because when we give something of ourselves with no other desire except the deity itself, then the deity gives something of itself to the giver. So as a result, there is a change of consciousness which takes place. So it becomes transformational. So we can have a transactional relationship with the divine or transformational relationship. So this is the other part that we have to remember. Then comes what can be given. Anything and everything can be given. Everything that we give, everything that we receive should be done in this spirit that I am giving to, not to somebody, but to the divine. And this could be giving not just external things, emotions, life energies, whatever, thought, again, knowledge, whatever we are giving, it should be done with the idea that it's being given to the divine. Divine work in the creation or to the divine directly. And whatever we receive, which actually goes on to saying that whether we receive in return good or suffering, all is received as the prasad of the divine. Whether people praise us or people criticize us, we should receive it as a gift of the grace. If we can do that, then yoga is on the royal road. If we cannot do it because equanimity has not been established, then of course there is still time to go. Why? How does it help? We are not asking suffering. But if it comes, and when the soul accepts it, then Sri Aurobindo says it, the soul in us prefers to go through the purifying ordeal of the suffering. Because it knows that the ego has to be crucified for the soul to be liberated. So when suffering comes in life, and we should not ask for it. To ask for suffering is a morbid thing. But if it comes to receive it, even that as a gratitude, all the ordeals as gratitude, then it ends up purifying us. So this is the whole logic in the idea of sacrifice. It is not self-immolation or self-torture. Self-torture is inflicting willfully injury to yourself. It is giving, which is different from torturing oneself. That I will not eat food, so I have given up my food. That is torturing oneself. And that has, okay, it has its own both advantages and disadvantages. But here it is giving something of what we have. So these are the issues in sacrifice. And then the question is, which is very interesting, of course, the knowledge in which all culminates is that by which thou shalt see all existence, becomings, without exception in the self. So there is the question mark. Then in me, there is the question mark. So here we see that the Gita first time introduces the concept of, it's an experience, we use the word concept because we are talking of it on mental ground, that there are three Purushas. So in Sankhya, to just get back a little, there is one Purusha. This Prakriti, which is becoming. And there is the Purusha, who is like a conscious intelligence. That's it. It's a universal intelligence. But it's impersonal. When it leans towards Prakriti and identifies with Prakriti, then Prakriti becomes active. It's inert, but it becomes conscious. Why? Because the conscious Purusha is looking at it. And we can take an example. The example is, a computer itself is inert, or an object is inert. But when a man engages with the object, it behaves as if it is conscious. If you look at a car and you don't see who is driving, nowadays you have driverless cars. So if you don't see who is driving the car, then looking at the car, you will feel the car is intelligent. So this is one of the, that's why Sankhya Darshan is called as atheistic philosophy. That you don't have to explain consciousness. It's just that there is this universal intelligence that we cannot deny. And when it identifies with nature, nature becomes active. It has, behaves consciously. So the method is, there is only this one Purusha. Each individual must withdraw oneself from Prakriti and all that intelligence it must put towards into nature, into the Purusha. And if it does that, by this constant withdrawal, ultimately it becomes freed. So this is the Sankhya. So there is one Purusha. Then in the Upanishad we will see two Purushas. So there is the Purusha who stands behind nature as the witness. So there is the nature and there is the Purusha. So this Purusha is anywhere and everywhere. You can ultimately, there is one Purusha, but the entire nature has ultimately emerged from this Purusha. But there is another status which is immutable, immobile Purusha, which has nothing to do with nature at all. It just is self-existent. That's what is called as Brahman in the Upanishads. So there is a Purusha which has some relation with the mutable becomings. Now, not going into whether there is an individual Purusha or one single Purusha. But essentially, this is the Purusha in the mutable becoming. The self or the divine. Divine is a better word. And why, we will see that. So in this mutable becoming of creation, there is the divine presence. To put it in very simple words. How are we to perceive it? Sri Krishna gives us a very simple way. He gives it later on. When we look at nature, anything which suddenly fills our heart with joy, gratitude, peace, a beautiful scene, a beautiful moment, a beautiful gesture, the blooming of a rose, the drifting of the stars, Shivindu says these are divine moments. Now, all these things basically is because there is a divine presence in creation. So creation is bhutani, all the many elements. And it's everywhere in everything. Even in things, when we look at it impersonally, even a snake with the hood raised. If you are too near, you feel afraid. But if you watch from a distance, magnificent. Wow, it's like lion leaping, magnificent. But if you go too near, then you are frightened. So there is the divine presence in creation, in all the mutable. Mutable is that which is changing, which is born, dies. In all this, there is the divine presence, and therefore we can suddenly, through the mutable, enter into the immutable. By just looking at it sometime, we can enter into that state of vast impersonality. People do that. They look at a star, they look at a flame, and suddenly they pass beyond it. Because the divine presence is everywhere. They enter into that one existence. They enter into that one consciousness, oneness. They can enter into the state of ananda. That's why people go into nature. It's there in human beings also, but very difficult to contact through human beings. So never meditate looking at a human being unless he's a guru, divine guru himself. So this is in the mutable. Then there is the immutable. So there it never enters into any of these ever-changing stuff. It's beyond. So meditation on the immutable Brahman is through an idea. That idea starts with, there is only Brahman, there is nothing else but Brahman, neti, neti, with the various ways. Because you have to start with a support. There cannot be anything without a support. So we can meditate upon the abstract Brahman, but very difficult because the mind will get lost. It must give some image, some form to the abstractness, and the mind cannot give that form. And therefore, the mind is unable to meditate upon the immutable Brahman unless some people can, very, very rare ones. But usually, you take the support of a form, usually the idea. So, one meditates on the idea that the divine presence beyond all, or all is Brahman, Sarva Khalvidam Brahman, is very powerful. So, when we meditate on all is Brahman, after a while, that idea drops and the experience begins to come alive within us. That's what Sri Krishna Sri Aurobindo is telling us, that when we meditate upon this great truth, great idea, and this doesn't require any posture while moving, walking. Now we are not looking through forms which are, manifestations of the divine in the becoming. We are going beyond the form. We are not concerned with the forms at all. By some inexplicable maya, that which is Brahman has become all this. And we are not interested in the becoming. So that's the second level. That we are only interested in that impersonality which is beyond all this creation. Why it has come? The metaphysical thinkers will say it has come because of maya. But we are not interested in understanding Maya. That's we are interested only in the immutable. So we go beyond creation, beyond manifestation into the impersonal. This is where Upanishad stops. But Sri Krishna brings the third Purusha, who is beyond these two. So it uses the word to qualify Purushottama, the Uttam Purusha, the highest Purusha. And that is the divine as being. That explains creation. Because being means all the aspects of the being is Sat, Chit, Ananda. So we see in creation, because he is a being, therefore all existences reflect him in one way or the other. He holds his own vast impersonality within himself. That means that which we call as Brahman of the Advaitin, that Brahman is within him. It's like a poise he can assume. At the same time, he can enter into relation with the world. So that is why Purushottama, these three Purushas are important. Because if there is only becoming and the divine as in mutable and the immutable, then there are only two possible alternatives for us. One is we can enter into that divine presence through the mutable. We can enter into that. As I said, looking at a rose, looking at the stars. Or we can bypass it entirely and enter into the immutable. But we can't form a personal relation. Because there is nobody there to form personal relation. There is no being. It's a state of consciousness. So Sri Krishna says this powerful thing. First, in the self with a capital S, then in me. So this is something very beautiful about the Gita. It doesn't deny or cancel these two experiences, but it takes them to a third level. From there, these two have come. That's how we can connect creation with the highest. Otherwise, there is no link between the creation and that. So here we have these three. So why he uses the word first in the self, then in me? Because otherwise we may form without entering into this state of immutable Brahman, knowing him beyond all this creation. Then our relation with the highest will only be limited by our own conception. Divine is this, divine is that. That relation we can form. But we will not arrive at the highest Purusha. That's why in the synthesis of yoga, Sri Aurobindo says, integral conception of the divine. And the mother explains it. That we have an idea of the divine. Divine is this, divine is not this, divine is that, he is not that. So when we go with these conceptions, the highest still is there. But he gets limited by our own conceptions. But when we go, we have experienced the immutable, or we simultaneously know that he is also the immutable. Then we are bound by no mental conception. We are free inwardly. And then we can really adore the highest Purushottama. So this is the idea of the sacrifice, because even when we sacrifice to the God or the highest, we do it with some mental conception of ours. And they are supports. No problem with that. But at some point we have to enter into that highest conception. That's why we see when Sri Aurobindo was asked, who is the mother? How does it start? The one whom we adore as the mother is the consciousness force of the Supreme. He doesn't say, don't you know who mother is? She was born in France. She came here on this date. He starts from there, then comes to the individual mother, so that we don't forget that totality, that supreme mystery. So that's why the three Purushas, and it's important because it means we can relate with God. See, you don't find that relation in the Upanishad. That's why you don't see that kind of bhakti. Bhakti has come later. It has come from the Puranic literature, and it's primarily we see with Sri Krishna's advent that bhakti comes. Because these three Purushas become very prominent. In Upanishad, there is a hint of bhakti, but it's not really bhakti, it's submission. Submission to the immutable, submission to the highest. So that's why he says the knowledge in which all culminates is that. So what is that knowledge which comes as a result of all this yoga? That thou shalt see all existences, becomings, bhutani, without exception in the self. So without exception means whatever their appearance. even in the ugliest, the most wicked, the most tortuous. And actually that should be the basis of brotherhood and whatever we want to practice. It cannot be a mental conception. Because we'll begin to fight. But the moment we start seeing the divine presence in all that becomings, then there is a solid foundation of unity. So for example, Auroville is meant to realize human unity. You can't do it with any external means. You can hold classes, you can have programs, oneness program, unity program. You can call people together. It's all right to do some common activity. But till we realize this truth, that means everybody in Auroville, by default, has to be a yogin, engaged in yoga. This is a discussion I had with somebody. He said, no, not necessary. I said, you cannot realize the dream of human unity through any other means. You will end up fighting. Temporarily, you can have truths, you can have understanding, you can have tolerance, you can have agreeing to disagree and all kinds of things possible. But there cannot be true unity unless we realize all existences in the self. But that's also not enough in me. In our context, we can say in mother. But the moment we see that, then the whole thing changes. See, it's one thing that all is in the divine. But see, when all is in the mother, just feel for a moment that you, me and everybody is in that vast impersonal reality. Now feel at next level. You, me and everything else is a child of the mother. See how the relation changes. It's a very different relation altogether. Covered, distorted, in appearance, all that is fine. One has to be sometimes formed with a child, of course. But nevertheless, everybody carries that portion of the divine in oneself. So this why, for the self is that one immutable, all-pervading, all-containing, all-existent, self-existent reality or Brahman hidden behind our mental being into which our consciousness widens out when it is liberated from the ego. We come to see all beings as becomings within that one self-existence. So people who meditate on this, ultimately they start looking at nature as they become witnesses. It becomes like a, not exactly illusion, but almost like, it's like on a cinema screen. And when we have this experience, a very powerful experience, then nothing really carries any meaning and nothing matters. So in one sense, you have widened. No doubt about it. But even this idea of brotherhood and unity is meaningless after that. Because there are no differences. There's only that one. So with whom you want to create unity, whom you want to realize that differentiation itself becomes meaningless. It's a very powerful experience. Shobindu says, the whole city becomes like a cinema which floats before the eyes and then it vanishes. It's a very powerful experience, not difficult to have at all. If for a few days one meditates on this idea, after some time, suddenly this experience rushes inside. And everything as if it's drowned in that, and it's very difficult to communicate anything, very difficult to react, act, mechanically one moves, does whatever is necessary, minimum. But one is not engaged with this world. That's how that great doctrine of liberation comes. There's no relation. But then, in me, then there is a relation that me is manifesting. But the self, or immutable, unchanging Brahman, we see too, to be the self-presentation to our essential psychological consciousness of a supreme being. Now comes the difference. See, this experience of impersonal Brahman is liberating. But problem with that liberation is, the Isha Upanishad speaks of it as that you enter into a great blindness. It makes no difference. Somebody living in that, you will say, you know what, India and Pakistan are at war. So one will say, smile. What difference does it make? No, there is evil which is, what difference does it make? Are your wife has been taken away by Ravana. What difference does it make? This is the idea of renunciation which has got into our head. But Ram, who is a Brahmagyani, but also a Purushottama, so he knows, because in becoming itself is a, he has presented himself to our psychological experience as the Brahman as well as in the mutable becoming. So we are relating with him. constantly. So this difference is so important. Otherwise, and this real experience, that whole world may vanish if you ask such a person who is really genuinely in that Brahmic consciousness. You tell him that, you know what, this what has happened. He says, it doesn't matter. It's an ever-changing world, appearance. But this appearance is the self-presentation of the being in this creation. And we can understand it very simply. What is the mountain? There are infinite qualities. So what is the mountain signifies? Austerity, climbing to the heights. Lion represents quiet power. Sun represents the creatrix. Stars, the guides at night. The fire, the purifying energy, all these are divine qualities. See, winds, they are the power of the divine that uplifts us. Or they can sometimes turn things topsy-turvy and create a massive change, upheaval. Water, so there is a way that the divine has presented himself. Here he is not saying how. He is not talking about the Vidyamay Maya and Avidyamay. The process is not saying. But he is saying it is a self-presentation. The whole world is an objectivization of the divine. So for example, the divine experiences within himself a great vastness. Not experience, he knows. It's his. So how to objectify that vastness? So material creation which is ever expanding universe. So through that immutable world, if you look at the material universe expanse, we can enter into the vastness of the divine. It is a self-presentation. Human beings, we ourselves are a self-presentation. And in fact, self-presentation of the highest. Sa purusha evascha. Our whole body is structured like that. So everything in this universe is a self-presentation. This is the word he has used. Self-presentation to our essential psychological consciousness of a supreme being, who is the source of our existence and of whom all that is mutable or immutable is the manifestation. Then only we can talk about transformation, relation with this world, meaningful relation, because all this belongs to the divine, is of the divine, divine is in all, and there is something which is going on. And therefore we can connect with it. Those who are only Brahmavadin, who seek an impersonal Brahman beyond all this world of ever-changing appearances, they don't understand this. Because for them, impersonal Brahman is there. Why you are caught in it? Don't worry about it. Get out of it. So this is the difficulty. And he makes it very clear. He is God. God brings that idea of personal relationship. We may not like, some people argue, evidence of God. You tell them, see, it will make no difference to God whether you believe him in or not believe in him. It makes no difference at all. But it will make a difference to you. That's all. You decide. Not that he will be partial toward the believer. Not that. Because the grace is equal. But when you have that bond of belief or of faith, you open to receive the guidance. That's the difference. So it's not that Krishna is partial towards Arjuna or Duryodhana. Of course, he will always be with Dharma. But he gave a fair choice. You choose. Me or the army. Arjun chooses Krishna. So what happens? He becomes open and receptive to the divine influence. So that is why when we use the word God, it's not about believing or not believing. It forms a connect. And we are free not to have any connection. He will still pour what he has to do. He doesn't. But we won't be able to receive it. That's why the importance of faith, aspiration, surrender. It's not that if we don't surrender, he's not going to. He will act because he is acting through the immutable, impersonal Brahman, where there is no partiality. Partiality he has none. But from the point of view of creation, it makes us more open. He is God, the divine, the Purushottama, the highest Purusha. To him we offer everything as a sacrifice, to that being in creation. Of course, in our context, it's the mother. To her we offer everything. From the smallest activity to the greatest, so-called greatest in our view, and open ourselves to her. That's why it's important. So this yoga is different from the yoga, slightly different. It's an enhancement and enlargement upon the yoga of the Vedas, the Upanishads and the Gita. This we must understand. Because very often people think it's the same thing. Whatever is there in Upanishads is there in the life divine, and whatever is there in the Gita is there with Sri Aurobindo and the mother. This creates a lot of confusion. So the three Purushas is important. People, the moment they talk about God, they think about religion. This is the other problem. We can form with God a religious relation. It's up to us. Nobody will stop us. By religious relation is meant a very external ritualistic relation we can form with God. We can form that relation with God. That I am doing this ritual and God will give me this. That's a religious relation. And we can narrow it down to utter fanaticism. That's our problem. Or we can form with God the widest possible relation, wherein all act becomes a sacrament, everything becomes a beautiful, if you want to call it a ritual offering, every life becomes a worship, breath becomes a song, heartbeat becomes a beating of our life in God. So that's up to us. So God with religion is our limitation. We can form if we like, but that's why people are afraid of the term. They prefer impersonal Brahman, immutable Brahman. But they don't like the word God. It's also true that in the name of God, a lot of evil has been done. But that's our problem, not God's problem. So then the question is, how to support the truthful and beautiful meanings of sacrifice? To be in the flow of the Supreme Conscious Force in oneself and in the atmosphere and consciousness of the earth, to be just open like this to the mother. And to act under her inspiration. And to act under her inspiration means to be very quiet. I'll give an example. We are meeting someone. We have so many ideas in the head. We always have ideas in the head. And they are like mindsets. Oh, this person in authority, he's like that. Even if we don't use the word, they are already in the head. Or we are meeting a child. What can the child tell me? Maybe God is waiting to speak through him. It's his play, his joy. Suddenly a child may say something which you have never imagined. I have at least benefited, you know. Suddenly a child says something. And it's like a revelation. Oh my God. He's so beautiful, so joyous. But we have all these mindsets. That's why, as I said, first the immutable. We must enter. Otherwise, you know, we have all these prejudices. Oh, what does my wife know? What does the child know? Nowadays also, what does the husband know? What does this man know? So always we are the only people who know in this world. But if we really get free of all these prejudices, all these mindsets, and go to everything, open to her, leaving it, surrendering to her, if we have to, let's say, practically what it means is, suddenly we are called upon to make it, you know, raise a voucher, let's say, for some money required for Savitri Bhavan. I'm putting it like this. So we are approaching with a mindset now. This person. Yeah, it won't meet a sanction, but still we must do as nishkam karma. Don't do like that. First, mutable becoming. Mother is even in that person. Number one. Second, immutable. Be free. What may happen may not happen. Don't create all these mindsets. So first approach, not a person, but through the person, the Divine Mother. I have seen things happen which are impossible. Apparently impossible. I have, you know, just sharing an experience. I had to buy something and for someone and I had gone there. And there was a cash crunch. There always is a cash crunch. And when you're buying, so the person tells me the cost and I am just thinking whether this will work out. And he says, I'll subtract this amount there. On his own. At the end, he ended up subtracting 19,000 rupees. I said not a word. I kept saying thank you, thank you, thank you. At the end, I asked him, what is your name? He said, Hari Mohan. I said, I understand. Hari Mohan needs understand. He didn't understand why I was beaming. I said, I understand. So, you see, apparently, if you go with, oh, he's a salesperson, he's going to cheat me, nothing. It's like that open. I said, if there, it's not there, not there. Finished. So, one should be open. That means not already determining the results, imagining the results. See, this liberation in the immutable Brahman frees you from all these mindsets, opinions, prejudices. And then the Divine Mother, ma, as you will, as you wish. Then the person takes either signs, refuses, don't have regrets. That is what is needed at this point of time. Receive it with gratitude in the heart and come back. So practically this is what it means in the flow. And this is with everybody and everyone. And it takes time. It's easy to say, but you know, every time we meet. And this should apply to everything in creation. Even to the most in violent situations. This too is the divine. To start with this idea, this faith, this too is the divine. Using this appearance, sometimes the appearance is very ugly, very dark, terrible. Mother Kali, like that tsunami or cyclone. Ma Kali. So it happens as we grow into the practice. This has to be practiced. That means this constantly, this remembrance of the divine in this triple mode should be always there. Not just one mode. So those who seek only after immutable Brahman, they can't appreciate the joy of nature. Mother speaks of one example. She says, I don't know whether it's true or not, but Swami Vivekananda, it seems, once remarked to someone who was saying, what a beautiful sunset it is. And he scolded him that if you think about sunset and start seeing all this, you cannot realize the Brahman. And the mother said, it always seemed to me. See, again she says, I don't know whether this story is true or not. I also don't know. But somebody told her. And she said, this is a poverty. It shouldn't happen like that. Through the mutable becoming, you can enter into that. That's what he says in the blue of the sky, in the green of the forest, whose is the hand that has painted the glow? When the winds were asleep in the womb of the ether, who was it raised them and bade them to blow? He says, he is lost in the heart, in the cavern of nature. He is found in the brain where he builds up the thought. In the pattern and bloom of the flower, he is woven. In the luminous net of the stars, he is caught. So this is this mutable becoming. In the laughter of a boy, in the blush of a girl. So everywhere in the mutable. Then he says, but these are his works. See the mutable becoming. These are his works and his ways and his shadows. But who is he then? By what name is he known? Is he Brahma or Vishnu? Man or a woman? Bodied or bodiless? Twin or alone? And then the Ishwara and Shakti. We have love for a boy who is dark and resplendent. A woman is lord of us, naked and fierce. And then he finally goes where? Into that ultimate. He is seated. See, that entire these three things we'll find in the poem. Who? After describing in the becoming and who is determining all things from above. He takes us to what point? The master of man and his infinite lover. He is close to our hearts, had we vision to see. We are lost in the pride and the pomp of our passions. We are bound by our thoughts where we hold ourselves free. And to what extent he takes still further. It is he in the sun who is ageless and deathless. And into the midnight his shadow is thrown. When darkness was dense and covered with darkness. See, when there is neither mutable nor immutable. Darkness was dense and covered with darkness. There is neither day nor night, as the Shruti says. Was there someone there? The Rig Veda says, we don't know. Aprakritem salilam. It says, we don't know. Gods cannot tell. If you read the Rig Veda, it says, we don't know. Who was there? Who can say? Even the gods can't say. Nasadhya sutra. Because they were not born. That's why they can't say. It's not about nastikta. Sri Aurobindo completes that picture. He says, it is he in the sun who is ageless and deathless, and into the midnight his shadow is thrown. When darkness was dense and covered with darkness, that is the primordial state, he was seated within it, immense and alone. You see, practically, if we live this with even with this idea, we'll be so free from everything. Free from fear, free from everything, wherever we are going, whomever we are meeting. Mother in so many forms. So it's a very great liberating and transforming truth. Mostly sacrifice is communicated as a duty and gets rejected. The most useless thing is this idea of duty. Why? Because duty is man-made and man-imposed. So we do duty. Why? Because it's the duty of the husband to look after wife and duty of the wife. Nowadays husbands are saying, earlier it was only duty of the wife to look after the husband. Duty of the child to look after the parents. Duty of the person who is working in a job to make the interest of the company as important. Duty of the person who is flirting around with politicians to please by praise. win favors. So this is duty. But is duty divine? A simple mental analysis will tell us it's not divine. Hitler's army would have said it's our duty. And well, they were doing the duty. The jihadi who blows himself up says it's my bounden duty because the Maulana has told me this is how God will be pleased. Imagine if the fellow for once thought that God is in my heart, not in that Maulana, not in the book. Let me feel in my heart whether what I am doing is true or not. He would have stopped. So duty is a man-made concept, a concept with which we have fooled around, and it has its place in the ignorance. But one who has turned to the divine has no other duty except to obey the divine will. As simple as that. And that's what we see in all our spiritual scriptures. When Mirabai asks Tulsidas, what shall I do? I love Krishna and my husband's side, they love Durga Ma. They eat meat. I am a pakka Vaishnava. I am a vegetarian. And they have ways of life which I can't conform to. What shall I do? So she writes to Tulsidas, the great poet of Ramcharitmanas. So he gives a very beautiful answer. He says, Jake priyana rama vaidehi, so chhaadiye taj koti bari sam adhipi param sanahi. He uses his own deity's name. Those who have no love for Rama and Sita, leave them aside. Even if they are very dear to you. And then he gives example from the Ramayana. Bharat did not listen to the duty. He abandoned his mother and governed the kingdom by going out of the kingdom because he says this unfair to Rama. Because Dharma, he abandoned his mother. Vibhishan abandoned his brother for the sake of good. It was his duty to look after the kingdom and fight with Ravana. He was a great warrior. But he did not. Why? Because he knew it's not the right thing. So he speaks about duty. So duty is a man-made thing. And that's why Ravan says you have done something wrong to Vibhishan. Even we unfortunately keep on saying ghar ka bhedi. He's not ghar ka bhedi. He's not one. He is with Dharma. His duty toward the divine is highest. So all the examples, Bali abandoned his guru. And of course the Gita is there. So mostly sacrifice is communicated as duty and gets rejected. It is not duty to start with. In the Auroville Charter has a similar fate, the expression, one must be a willing servitor of the divine consciousness. And I would add, if not, then why is one here? I mean, I have not understood. People in the ashram context also ask. I said, then why are we here? What is the point? There are difficulties, there are challenges. Everywhere there are challenges. But here the goal is different. Yes, challenges will be there. Some people would be nasty. Some you may like, you may not like. Sometimes you may not get what you felt was best. But yet, nobody can stop you from turning everything towards yoga by seeing the divine in it. So this idea, see people, it's also, I do believe that there is a problem at the entry level, since you mentioned. So it's very important, because if you go through what Mother has written about people coming to Auroville, who is to be taken in, who is to be even sent away. So it's not like anyone and everyone, it's a free place and there is freedom. It's to realize our own idea of unity, our own idea of brotherhood, our own idea of freedom. No, it's the divine idea of brotherhood, divine idea of unity, divine idea of freedom, which is very different from our human conception. If we are not ready to abandon the human conceptions and exchange them for the divine truth, then we are not engaged in yoga. It's okay. I mean, people are free to be whatever they want to be, but one has to be a willing servitor of the divine. Mother has used the word divine consciousness. We need to understand. that why she spoke like that. She didn't speak like that in ashram, because she knew that many people will come from a Western context where the idea of God is like, has been almost slain, and for good reason, because of the antagonism that took place, without understanding the deeper truth. And it has done a lot of damage. Because see, we threw away, as they say, baby with the bathwater. So what has happened as a result? Now we see that, you know, the religious sense is dying away, the sacred sense is dying away, and it's under the siege of woke and all these things because of this region. Whereas here it has been preserved. So that's why she used the word divine consciousness, perfect consciousness. But very clearly it is mother. When you use the word Matri Mandir, it's not mandir in that sense, but mother is there. It's a temple dedicated to the divine mother. So to be a servitor of the divine consciousness, one has to practice all the things which are part of the Karma Yoga, which means sacrifice of the ego, not for getting this or that, not for fulfillment of my own ideas, my own comforts, but for the joy of giving oneself to the divine. That's what it means. How to recognize the beauty of the divine creation as the presence of becoming? For me, it seems to be the way to learn it. Yes, as I said, look at anything. Actually, so many things in creation. Every season one can feel something of the divine. So I often use this actually seasons as analogy. Spring, divine bursting forth into creative splendor. Richness, diversity. Diversity is an aspect of the divine because he is infinite. Rains, purifying waters of grace, thrashing the earth. Oh, before that, sorry. Summer, toil and tapasya. Sweat and tears. Sweat and blood and tears. See, the four stages of life are also like that. Then the purifying waters of grace. And then when the divine withdraws and turns himself in an inwardness, autumn. Each has its own beauty. Everything has its beauty actually. When something is being built, there is a beauty. When something is being destroyed, we cannot see it. It is also a divine action. Shiva Tandav. Worlds collapse. Look at Mahabharata. Men are quartered and strewn apart. How many survived out of the 18 Akshayini? One Akshayini is some about, how many? About maybe few thousands at least. Maybe around a lakh at the most, you say. So 18 lakh or little less than that. Army. How many survived in the Mahabharata war? 18. Did God not know what he is doing? Shivinda says, sometimes he hammers the world fiercely. And he says, why he hammers? Because we are not ready for the softer, gentler notes. So when we are not ready to hear the Veena of Saraswati, or the flute of Krishna, then he comes with the trumpet and the conch shell. Trumpet is war cry and the conch shell is victory. Or the Shiva Tandav with the damru. So basically, in everything, Shivinda says that even in the tempest, the storm, I mean, even in the, again, you know, we were talking about felling of the trees. Yes, in everything we have to see the divine. Don't the storms remove things? Why do they do so? Maybe we have to look inside ourselves. Things could have grown beautifully, harmoniously. They are not happening that way. Somewhere we deviated from something which is true and beautiful. So the blows come. We may not like it. We may have our own ideas. Perfectly fine. As I said, it makes no difference to the divine whether we have this idea or that idea. So the only sane way is to discover the divine idea in creation and abide by it. Our ideas make no difference to the divine play. There were people in the war who told Krishna names on the battlefield. If you read the Mahabharata, Burishava, he says, what kind of a person you are? I can't even repeat things. Shishupal. Oh, Krishna. We know, we know. You don't have to listen to him. Krishna didn't bother. He did what was needed to be done. You must understand, there is an aspect of the divine which can be very fierce and terrible. Worlds can be destroyed. Pralaya. Why? Because we are not ready. If we keep deviating from the divine plan, what will happen ultimately? He's not going to just say, okay, everything fine. He can't just soft coddle it. At some point, we may see the Ugra Roop, and that's terrible. So we must understand that he is in storm, in tempest. Everywhere it is the divine. So in the Auroville context, so when we do as a servitor of the divine consciousness, means doing as a nishkam karma. Nothing else I want but growing closeness with the divine, inner contact with the divine, nearness to the divine, becoming one with the divine, helping in the divine manifestation, collaborating with the divine. That's the only aspiration. If one does a work with some idea that, you know, this is going to stay forever. Oh, I built it with my own hands and see what has happened today. All this is anyogic. It may be the best of things. Who knows? But in my own experience and what Sri Aurobindo has said, whenever something is raised to the ground, something more beautiful is going to come. We should participate in that, because divine in the becoming is always moving forward. Imagine if the world had been stuck 500 years back and never moved forward. There would have been gladiators. There would have been all kinds of sacrifice. Even now people do animal sacrifice, which is the most stupid thing to do in the name of God. But all these things would have continued. If those people said, no, we don't want to budge. This is our tradition, this is our way of life. So we have to understand divine in the becoming is always moving forward. So whatever we may have done yesterday, we have to do something much more. To complete what we were talking about, that see, when people came early in Auroville and ashram and they labored, you know, that they with bare hands, many of them, when you see, literally sweat and blood and tears, and they are building, they are laboring 18 hours a day, 12 hours a day. Now, we are called upon to do a much greater labor. The basic structure and foundation has been built. Now the labor is to build within us the temple of God. It's a far more difficult thing. You should not that they won't have tried it. I'm sure they would have tried it. But given the fights that took place and the doubts, and mother herself has said, people who are going to come, the generations, they are going to love me much more than you people. She spoke to Huta when she asked her, she said, you don't know, the children who are going to come, they're going to love me much more. So the labor that we are called upon to do is an even greater labor. Because this is not finished. This is the outer structure. We have to install the divine presence in every house, in every body, in every mind, which is the difficult part. So that's being a willing servitor of the divine. Okay, I was going to read with best wishes and gratitude. Okay. So this is all the questions. If there is anything quick, we can take one. Probably, otherwise we can. So gratitude for the questions, lovely questions. Yes, so they always open a wide door. Yes. Divine manifestation by its nature means that we cannot treat anything as a finished product. Neither ourselves, nor a group life, nor a structure. We should be very clear on this. I'm not saying we should have our idea what should come. Mother has fortunately given us everything. But also there would be things which, situations which we don't know. Everything cannot be written. So we have to be quiet, open ourselves inwardly and act according to that true impulsion. It may not be exactly the true impulsion, but at least we should have made an effort to do that. And then even if it is not exactly what the divine wants, there is some distortion within because of our own notions, she will correct it. Doesn't matter. We would have done the right things by taking the right attitude. So that means we have not to give any selfish consideration to things, egoistic considerations. And that's why, to put it in the end, when there is a quarrel between two groups or many groups, taking sides, unless you are very sure, don't take sides, stand by the side of God. So in Mahabharata war, who was taking sides? No. Those who took sides, they were all gone. But they who stood with Krishna, that's what is important. Stand by the mother. That's all that is required. Taking sides in ignorance, then again, as I said, mock fight. We create a problem, then we try to solve it, whereas there was no problem. Things have to be, they will evolve, they will grow, and India will go through these phases, world will go through, every nation is going through these phases, people get upset, individually we go through these phases, group life goes through these phases. How else will evolution take place? If everything remains forever as it was, and then we only sing, oh, so lovely life is. No. That's not manifestation, that's not evolution. Okay. Close. Thank you. Jai Ma.